I did not know much about physics, but I knew enough to see that the light around the alien landing did not behave like natural light. It didn't move, it spread like a viscous fluid, slowly flooding the forest and engulfing everything it touched in a bright silvery blanket. Burrowing through a 3-foot mound of snow on the side of the hill, I tried to forget about the phantom light and concentrate on the aliens. We were directly between the origin of the light and Valhalla. Somewhere in that light, an alien army was headed our way. I had no idea how many soldiers the enemy might bring, but it seemed likely that an intergalactic army might rely on overwhelming force to secure new territories, wipe their enemies out entirely, then move on to the next conquest. Beginning soon, a million soldiers might pass this glade.
Get comfortable, boys. We may be here for a long, long time. Keep your eyes open, but hold your fire. We do not want to engage. Repeat, we do not want to engage.
What if they spot us?
Just sit tight, messman. Don't start shooting until I give you the order.
Yes, sir.
Now that the flood of light had spread over us, my visor automatically switched to tactical lenses with moderate tinting to protect my eyes from the glare. The light had enveloped the forest for as far as I could see. Using the Geiger counter in my visor, I checked for radiation and found nothing. The environmental equipment showed no change in air temperature, and I could see that the light did not melt the snow, which glistened like a blanket of diamond fragments along the ridge.
Holy shit! Look at that ugly specker!
Phillips spotted the angels first.
I saw the video feed, but I didn't believe it.
The creatures looked like they were made out of light, but not the same light that now flooded the forest. The liquid light pouring across the forest was silver white like raw electricity. The creatures were bright yellow. The first space angels around the bend looked like statues sculpted from yellow neon light. Their movements were stiff and stilted, as if their limbs had somehow become locked by the snow. Made of light or glass, they marched along the ground. No floating, no flying, no vehicles. Instead, column after column of 8-foot-tall soldiers that looked no more substantial than a smear of light marched along the ground below us. They had heads, arms, and legs, all with fairly human proportions, only larger. They carried enormous chrome rifles across their chests. The aliens might have looked like they were made out of energy, but those damned rifles seemed pretty specking real. Marching past us, the angels never spared so much as a sideways glance. If I'd had more men, guns, and guts, I might have tried to end the war right then and there. The minutes passed by slowly as we lay hidden watching the alien army parade past. Zooming in with the telescopic lens in my visor, I studied the faces of some of the creatures. At first glance, they all looked alike to me, like ants or fish. They all had the same big eyes and jutting lower jaws. Their size, about 8 feet tall and broad as bears, seemed uniform. Their size and shape was the only constant. The first space angels looked more like body-shaped auras than living creatures. As more passed, however, the aliens started to take on a sand-colored look. Their bodies began to look like they were made out of substance instead of light, as if some kind of crust was forming around them. They continued to get darker as they marched past us. Bulky, statuesque soldiers with an iron-gray patina on their skin replaced the sleek creatures with the golden translucence. These aliens had huge, featureless bodies. I saw no seams or edges to suggest that they were wearing clothes or armor, nor cavities or lines to suggest they were naked. Aside from arms, limbs, and heads, the bodies had no features at all. They had nothing even remotely resembling hair on their limbs or pumpkin-shaped heads. I did notice that a few of the creatures had cracks in the outer crust that formed on their bodies. I could see yellow-colored light shining through those cracks. The seemingly endless procession of aliens continued to file past us. At one point, I realized that their numbers were in the tens of thousands. Not long after that, the column ended abruptly.
They're gone. Stay where you are. That might have only been the scouts.
We remained hidden in our snowy camouflage for several more minutes, but no additional aliens materialized.
I'm open to suggestions.
I spoke over the command line so that only Tomer, Phillips, and Freeman heard me.
It didn't seem like there were enough of them to take over a planet.
He's right, sir. That can't be all of them.
Well, I suppose it depends on what each of them can do. If those guns fire nukes, they'll toast us in an afternoon. What do you think, Ray? Do you think they landed more troops somewhere else?
One landing site. That's all we've ever seen.
If that's all they need to capture a planet, those are gonna be some pretty damn tough mother speckers. Either that, or we're gonna carve those boys new assholes when they reach Valhalla.
Maybe we should get back to Valhalla. They may need all the help they can get.
Tomer, there are 400,000 Marines, 600,000 soldiers, and about a trillion surface-to-surface missiles waiting down there. You can't possibly think the 40 of us are going to make a difference.
There's no point heading back to Valhalla.
I switched to the open frequency and spoke to the entire platoon.
We're going to follow the bastards' tracks and see where they came from. If we find their base, maybe we can spec with it. Now move out. Freeman, you picking up anything I should be concerned about?
Freeman surprised me by removing his helmet. The temperature had dropped to below freezing, and steam formed when he breathed. He reached into one of his utility pockets and removed a small laser scope, which he pointed into the sky.
Did you get a good look at the sky?
You mean the colors?
Freeman looked back at me and nodded.
Take a look through this.
I pulled off my helmet and aimed the scope into the sky. Sensors within its housing ran an instant retinal diagnostic, then projected a hairline laser as a direct extension of the angle of my vision. Markings along the edges of the scope displayed the distance between my eye and the target. As I looked across the forest, I marked 37 feet, 3.5 inches between me and a tree. I marked 4 feet, 1.8 inches between me and Freeman. When I looked up into the sky, both the end of the laser beam and the numbers vanished.
Something's wrong with your scope.
Freeman replaced his helmet over his head. I did the same, glad to feel the warmth around my face.
There's something in this light that disassembles waves.
I could still see shimmering strokes of blue, red, and yellow above us. It never occurred to me that they might be the frayed edges of the light around us. If no waves could penetrate this light field, we were cut off from the rest of the galaxy. And that made sense. Once the planets were sleeved, they were cut off. We were cut off.
Tomer, Phillips, have your men run an equipment check.
I toyed with the idea that mankind might have kicked these aliens' asses on all of the other 179 populated worlds, and we wouldn't know it. But I knew that these guys would not have been able to cross 100,000 light-years of space, sleeving every planet they passed, unless they had something going for them. There had to be something more, something we were overlooking.
Sir, Lieutenant, all of the equipment checks out.
Thank you, Sergeant.
I switched to an open frequency channel.
Listen up. I want to take one of those bastards home alive. You got that? Break into fire teams. We're going to sweep the woods. I want to find some scouts. If you see a column heading your way, dig in and radio me. If you see some stragglers, I don't care if they are watching birds, eating babies, or building a memorial to peace in the universe. You will not repeat, not attack. You contact me, and the entire platoon will converge before you make a move. Head north and west toward their original position. Platoon leader, Phantom out.
Tomer, my platoon leader, took over from there. Leaving the hill, I took one last look around the scene. The way the Space Angels had lit this thick forest fascinated me. There were no shadows. The light came from every direction instead of one. They really had flooded the place with some sort of illumination that behaved like liquid.
Lieutenant, we found the place where the aliens landed.
Any unfriendlies, Phillips?
Nah, not an alien soul inside.
Do they have buildings? Is there any kind of fortification?
Nope. But they got awful big balls.
What are you talking about? Put up a beacon and stay hidden.
On my visor, Phillips' virtual beacon looked like a translucent red fence that ran through the forest. The same line would appear on every man's visor.
Platoon, converge on beacon.
The path Phillips had taken led through trees, over a creek, and around several clearings. By this time, the entire forest was as bright as desert under a midday sun. As I climbed over a gentle rise, I found Phillips sitting on a log supervising as his men searched the area. There, partially hidden by a pocket of trees, sat a perfectly round sphere of light. It was approximately 10 feet in diameter and appeared to be constructed of nothing but light. Until the moment I saw that sphere, I had thought that nothing could be as pure and bright as the light filling the forest, but that sphere proved me wrong. The tint shields in my visor doubled themselves to protect my eyes as I stared into the ball of light. As I examined it, Ray Freeman came up beside me. I did not need to see Freeman's virtual dog tag to recognize him.
Is that some kind of portal?
Until that moment, I had not yet grasped the significance of these aliens traveling across space without a ship. They had somehow ridden in on this light. We were still tramping around the galaxy and specking spaceships, while these aliens simply materialized wherever they wanted. Our technology was primitive compared to theirs.
Are you sure this is how they got here?
Phillips pointed to the ground around the sphere.
The footsteps start right there. I figure they must have come out of that thing when they started their march.
Why didn't they leave some sort of guard?
To guard what? What are we going to do, cut the power? It's a speckin' ball of light.
Leaving it unguarded doesn't seem very military.
It's so clear, it's practically not there.
Freeman removed his helmet and shined his laser scope into the sphere. He replaced the scope in its pouch and put on his helmet.
Well, did the beam get through?
They're not detecting motion.
I was about to ask more when I got a signal from base command and General Glade addressed me.
Lieutenant Harris, I just viewed your report.
Have they reached the city yet?
They're not here yet, Lieutenant, but it won't be long now. Do you have anything new to report? Any luck catching one of those bastards?
No, sir.
Even as I said this, I noticed something strange. The light in the sphere had begun pulsing.
Fall back.
What's happening out there?
I'll send you what I'm seeing.
I backed behind a tree and crouched. Using optical commands, I forwarded the images in my visor to Glade. Then I forgot about him entirely. The sphere stretched as if it were made out of rubber. It doubled in size until it was 20 feet tall, then expanded again so that it was now as tall as the trees around it. As it stretched to an oval shape, I saw that there were more space angels inside it. Hundreds of them.
Harris, get your men out of there! Harris, go!
General, I need to go.
We might have done better attacking the aliens than showing them our backs. We needed to stay calm, and we needed to stay hidden.
Steady, boys. Get comfortable. It looks like we might be here for a while.
The figures inside the sphere had a gold cast to them. Otherwise, they might have been completely invisible. Space angels, monsters, alien invaders, whatever you called them, here they were. They sort of congealed in the light and strode right out of that sphere without a moment's pause.
You seeing this?
Good God! How the speck are we supposed to fight something like that?
The way they glowed as they stepped out of that sphere, the creatures could not possibly have been made of solid matter. They looked like gold extensions of the white gold light inside the sphere and nothing more. The creatures carried those oversized rifles, but inside the sphere, even the rifles looked like they were made out of light. More aliens came, but not in the large numbers they had before. We hid behind trees, rocks, and ferns, watching them stroll out of that sphere for 40 minutes. This time, no more than 1,000 aliens materialized. If this was the second wave of the invasion, it was even more pathetic than the first wave. The aliens did not bother themselves with such details as securing the area when they emerged from the sphere. They formed into loose ranks and disappeared into the brightly lit folds of the forest. As I crouched down behind a rock, I noticed that the angels did not speak to each other. Having just materialized as little more than light, they might not have had the organs needed to speak to each other even if they'd wanted to. I assumed that this sphere employed some variant of the broadcast technology we use to transport ships. The aliens coming out of the sphere, having had their molecular structure hyper-accelerated, seemed more like they were made out of energy than matter. Maybe that was what gave them that radiant appearance. As we had seen when their army passed us before, they cooled down into matter with time. Even in this energy form, they did have weight. Their feet sank into the squishy mud around the sphere. When they stepped forward, mud stuck to their feet. The sphere began compressing into itself, but even as it shrank, three final figures emerged from it. Two of these last aliens carried rifles. The third appeared to be empty-handed. They stepped out of the light, stood still for a moment, and followed the rest of their ranks into the forest. Watching the aliens vanish into the trees, I felt relief. This was not the innumerable army I'd expected. Nor were these the nightmarish battle conditions of the Mogat invasion, not with the forest filled with light.
You want me to go after those last ones, sir? I can take a squad.
Send Phillips after them. Tell him to track them down, but not to engage. I want to be there when the shooting starts.
Aye, aye.
And Tomer. Make sure he knows his ass is on the line.
Moments later, five men split off from us. I turned to survey the area and saw Freeman approaching the sphere.
What are you doing?
He pulled a pistol from his armor. As a civilian, Freeman could carry whatever equipment he saw fit. When it came to battle arms, we government issue types carried M27s and particle beam pistols, and that was about it. Knives were optional. Freeman stood about 20 feet from the sphere and leveled his pistol. The bullets struck a tree on the other side.
Basic physics. Light and bullets don't mess with each other.
Ever fired a bullet through a laser stream?
As a matter of fact, I had. That was the kind of mischief we pulled back in the orphanage. For young military clones, firing guns and experimenting with battle lasers was a wild time. We'd sneak off to the range and crossfire bullets through a laser beam. The bullets ended up as formless blobs.
Do you think this thing is a laser of some sort?
After pocketing the pistol, Freeman pulled out a particle beam pistol. He walked around the sphere until he had a straight shot at the tree he had hit with his bullets. Freeman held his pistol a few inches from the trunk.
What the hell are you doing?
running a scientific experiment.
Freeman put the particle beam pistol away and produced a combat knife with an 8-inch serrated blade. Then he went to the trunk and began digging out his bullets. After prying the first of the bullets out of the stump with his knife, Freeman held it up for me to see. The bullet glowed as if he had just pulled it out of a furnace. I switched the lenses in my visor to heat vision, but the shell was not hot. It simply glowed.
I wouldn't touch that. It might be radioactive.
I already checked.
Freeman dropped the bullet into a bag. He dug out a second shell and placed it into his bag with the first bullet.
Tomer, send some men out to sweep the area. I want to know if there are any more of these light spheres out here.
Aye, aye.
I walked closer to the sphere.
Harris, the aliens have begun their attack.
It was not General Glade, but Lieutenant Moffat who contacted me.
Intel is estimating their forces at approximately 50,000 troops. How the speck do they expect to invade us with 50,000 troops?
Are they putting up much of a fight?
We were a lot more scared of these guys before they got here. They beat the shit out of our gunships, but our ground troops are holding their own. So far, they don't look all that specking dangerous.
Have you been up to the front line?
The army is taking this one. How about you? Any luck capturing a live one?
Not yet. We found where they landed, if you can call it a landing. It looks more like they broadcast in.
Broadcast in. Nice. Very nice. What's the ETA on your return?
I was hoping to look around a bit longer.
There's no rush, Harris. Dig up what you can and get back here when you're done.
I stood there thinking about the aliens. The Unified Authority had just survived a civil war with the Mogats, an enemy with next to no military experience and no ground troops. Survived was the optimal term. The Mogats won too many battles before we finally tracked them down and eviscerated them. Now we were fighting an alien invader that telegraphed its battle plans and sent 50,000 troops to battle our million.
Lieutenant Harris, we found 9 more of those chambers.
Chambers?
The glowing balls. We found 9 more of them just north of here.
Good work, Tomer. Bring your men back. I just got a report from Moffat. The fireworks have started. Freeman, what do you think about setting up a line of trackers to guard the area? If the bastards send in reinforcements, maybe we can pop them as quickly as they appear.
At that moment, it all seemed so easy. If our lines could just hold outside Valhalla, these alien bastards could be killed. The once impossible war now seemed so winnable. For the first time since my meeting with Admiral Brocious, I could close my eyes and see the end of the war. The possibilities seemed endless.
We found their scouts.
Phillips and his fire team had been tracking the aliens for most of an hour.
Are they still a party of 3?
If you still want to take one alive, Capitan, the odds aren't going to get any better. Want me to take them?
How close can you get?
How close do you want me to get? It's like tracking stiffs. I bet I can get close enough to piss on them.
Close enough to piss on them?
Well, maybe not against the wind. I don't know if these boys are fresh out of alien boot camp or just plain stupid. But they sure as hell don't act like they're galaxy conquerors.
They might still have something up their sleeve.
So can I move in?
Send up a beacon. Don't move till I get there.
Yes, sir.
Do not engage them, Sergeant. If I hear shots, you better hope they kill you first. I'm on my way.
Got it, sir.
Tomer, take the rest of the platoon back to town. I'm going after Phillips Deacon.
Freeman went with the platoon so he could deliver his bullets to the science lab for analysis. By this time, nearly 4 hours had passed since we first sighted the Phantom Lights. The ion curtain had long since closed around New Copenhagen, cutting us off from the rest of mankind. Cutting across a clearing, I looked into the sky for signs that the light field was fading, but it was as solid as ever. The woodland around me was unnaturally bright. Even under the trees and in the deepest thickets, I could see patches of mossy ground that sunshine would never have reached under normal circumstances. Light sparkled off distant snowdrifts.
You're not gonna believe this, Harris. The fight's over. We routed the bastards.
It's over?
They folded, the specking jokers, just plain folded.
Any signs there might be more of them on the way?
I was gonna ask you the same question. If this was the whole damn war, then...
One of my fire teams is tracking some scouts. We're gonna bring one in.
You might want to hurry back. The party's already started.
Just make sure you don't drink Valhalla dry before we get there.
Tell you what, Harris. You bring back a live one, and I'll find the best bottle in the whole specking city for you!
I wanted to feel excited by his news, but I knew better. It was beginning to feel as if we could win the war, but it could not possibly happen this easily and this quickly. Phillips Beacon led through well-trafficked territory where snow, ferns, and small trees had been tromped into the mud. Soon, though, the beacon took me into a less-traveled glen. Virgin snow with a few footprint trails gleamed in the bright light. The aliens followed a natural pathway that led through thin growth, while Phillips and his men had stuck to the trees. I recognized their boot prints. The aliens' feet left rectangular prints in the shallow snow. When they reached drifts, the bastards sloshed through without lifting their feet out of the snow. Instead of leaving a line of individual prints, they dragged their feet and left ruts in their wake. I spotted Hewish before I saw the others. He was kneeling in a small gully, his gun trained on the enemy and his finger on the trigger, waiting for the order to shoot. I identified him by the virtual dog tag over his helmet.
What is the situation?
They're just over that rise, about 30 yards out. Phillips and Harrington are moving in for a better angle.
I hid behind a tree and surveyed the scene. Looking along the edge of the gully, I spotted White and Bowl. Phillips and Harrington lay flat on the ground in a patch of ferns. I don't know how well concealed they were from the aliens, but it took me a few moments to spot them.
Do you have a good line on them?
All three of them. Can we get this show underway, sir? Now that you're here to help?
I stole up the rise, cutting through the ferns at a crouch. Below us, the ground seemed to form a bowl, offering the aliens no protection. One of the aliens knelt and played with some sort of scientific instrument, while two others stood guard. The one with the instrument was poking a 4-inch needle into the ground.
Maybe they're a science team.
Bet you're right. Can we cap them now?
I want to take the one checking the soil home with us, alive.
Got it.
Phillips signaled Hewish and Harrington to flank the aliens from behind. I sighted in on one of the guards as Phillips assigned targets to his men. The creature's eyes were the same color as the rest of his face. They looked no more lifelike than the eyes on a marble statue. The face had a more or less human-looking mouth and nose. There was that one brief moment of anticipation as every man took his place and homed in on his target. On my visor, the names Tom, Dick, and Harry appeared above the three aliens. Tom and Dick were the guards. Harry was the scientist. Phillips had placed these designations so that we all knew what we were doing.
Lieutenant Harris wants to take Harry home with him. Bowl, Harrington, you guys smack Tom. Take him out fast. Hewish, you and I get Dick.
What about me?
White, you make sure Harry doesn't get away. Lieutenant Harris has a thing for him.
Take him out!
I fired a 3-shot burst. The bullet struck Dick on the side of his head, just above the tiny nubs that looked like ears. Sparks flashed where the first bullet struck, as if it had glanced off a rock. The second and third chipped at the head, producing a shallow gash. Dick spun to face me. Its face was impassive. Its eyes seemed as fixed as flint stones. It must have been searching for me, but I could not tell by looking at those eyes. I aimed at its forehead. The alien stumbled backward. I wasn't the only one shooting the bastard. More chips spattered off its back and shoulders.
What do I have to do to kill this specker?
I aimed at one of its eyes. The eye chipped, and nothing leaked from the hole, as if the alien had been carved out of stone.
Spear! I hit that bastard in his nuts! Go down, asshole! You're nuts, you bastard!
Harry, the scientist alien, stopped taking readings and ran to join the guards. Dick's rifle fired. A yard-long bolt of white light flared from its muzzle. The bolt traveled through the air at the absolute speed limit of what a man could track with his eyes. I perceived that bolt as much as saw it, watching where it started and where it struck while my mind filled in the holes. The light bolt struck a thick mound of dirt to my right, cut through the mound, and continued through the air.
Fall back!
I agreed with that order, but I did not follow, aiming my M27 at Dick's right shoulder. I must have fired 20 rounds within a 2-inch spread before the alien stumbled backward. I continued shooting as the shoulder dented, fractured, then splintered. Dick's right arm fell to the ground and his rifle fell with it. Bowl, a grenadier, popped out from a ditch and fired a rocket that hit the ground somewhere between Tom and Harry. The explosion sent the aliens flying in opposite directions. One crashed into a tree, spun partway around its trunk, then landed 20 feet farther on. I did not see where the other alien landed. By this time, capturing prisoners was the last thing on my mind. All I cared about was getting my men out of this skirmish alive. When Dick rose to his feet and picked up the rifle with his remaining arm, Bowl fired a rocket at the bastard. It simply split Dick in half. His body broke. Bowl fired another rocket, striking Harry in the chest and blowing him apart, while Phillips and Harrington continued firing at him. It was not until the shooting stopped that I noticed that both Hewish and White had been hit. White lay flat on the ground, a fist-sized hole seared through the back of his armor. One of the alien bolts had passed through 10 feet of ground, through Private First Class Stephen White, armor and all, and continued on into the trees beyond. The wound was clean, cauterized, and probably instantly fatal. A wisp of steam rose from that hole. Heat from the bolt had melted his armor, leaving a stream of polymerized metal dribbling into the hole in his back. If I had chosen to place my hand in that hole, it would have come out clean. There was no blood. Hewish was not so lucky. The bolt had passed through his right shoulder, taking a small and clean chunk with it. The wound might not have killed him had he not gone into severe shock. He lay on his back, shivering convulsively like a man in an icebox. Phillips and I stayed with Hewish while Harrington and Bull went out to gather the body parts and equipment the aliens left behind. Phillips pulled off Hewish's helmet and loosened his chest plate. He could not pull the plate off because so much of it had fused into the wound. By the time Harrington and Bull returned with alien body parts, a rifle, and the meter that Harry had been using, PFC Hewish had died.
Moffat, we're coming in. Has the rest of the platoon arrived?
President accounted for. Sergeant Thomas says you stayed back to catch a prisoner. How'd it go?
I've got some body parts and a weapon.
General Glade wanted a live one. We don't need more body parts or weapons.
We captured some of their scientific equipment. I think they were taking soil samples.
Scientific equipment. Not bad, Harris. Not bad. It doesn't earn you the best bottle of booze in Valhalla, but I'll spot your first round in the officer's lounge.
We lost two men.
Non-coms?
White and Hewish. Both privates.
Good men, I'm sure.
While Bull cut down branches and built a travois for carrying back our dead, Harrington brought me one of the aliens' rifles. Its stock was featureless and lacked even a trigger. It looked like a nickel-plated pipe and weighed well over 50 pounds. Harrington also brought in a head and a long section of back. Looking over these parts, I saw no signs of muscles, veins, tissue, or bone. The limbs we found were solid and unmalleable. There was no tissue. The body parts had the same composition inside and out.
Only the meter. Moffat says they've got all the body parts they can handle.
Harrington helped Bull load the bodies onto the travois. I watched them lift and lower the bodies as they lashed them into place. They strapped Hewish on the travois first. Watching the scene, I noticed how his armor was stiff, but his limbs hung limp.
So we attacked him for nothing. We got this.
I held up the soil reading tool that Bull retrieved.
Well, that makes me feel a whole speckin' lot better. As long as we aren't leaving this specked-up mission empty-handed.
Watch it, Sergeant.
Moffat called in a couple of hours after we started back to town.
Where are you?
We're headed toward town.
As far as we can tell, the woods around the city are clear. Maybe I should send a patrol to bring you in, just in case.
I appreciate it.
We broke off our transmission, and I took a moment to stare out into the diamond-bright sky. It looked like midday, with direct sunlight coming down from every direction. I could not see Valhalla itself, we were too far from town, but I could see smoke rising from that direction. Phillips, who was scouting up ahead, radioed me.
The air is clear.
Base command says the woods are clear all the way to town.
If Lieutenant Moffat is so speckin' sure it's safe, why the hell doesn't he come get us?
He is.
Harris, did you see those bastards, goddammit? Those sons of bitches are bulletproof. They're damn near rocket-proof. Now what are we doing out here, Harris? What the speck did we accomplish?
We killed three of theirs.
Yeah. They killed two of ours. We had the speck and drop on them, and they still nailed us.
We continued toward town, Phillips and I moving ahead in silence. Another hour passed. I never saw Phillips. I could tell he was somewhere ahead of us, but he kept himself hidden in the trees. When we reached a clearing in which a 300-foot radio tower stood, I found Phillips resting at the edge of the trees.
We didn't kill him. We speck and broke them. They're like chunks of metal or something. And who the speck cares if we nail them? They're just speck and statues.
There are a lot more of us than there are of them.
What?
We have over 1 million troops defending Valhalla. They're going to run out of men before we do.
We crossed the clearing, passing under that radio tower.
You want someone else to scout for a while?
We're almost back.
Phillips sped on ahead, vanishing behind the first row of trees.
How are you two doing?
I turned to Harrington and Bull. They had the hard job, dragging a 350-pound load on a travois through the snow. They didn't complain, though, and when I offered to take my turn pulling, they turned me down. 5 minutes later, Phillips radioed in to say that he had rendezvoused with Moffat and his welcoming party. They escorted us back to town. The Hotel Valhalla was quite the billet. Officers had rooms to themselves. Enlisted men stayed in the convention center, where barracks had been set up in the enormous ballrooms. Before heading in for a debriefing with General Glade, I swung through the Valkyrie ballroom to look in on my men. Entering the cavernous room, I discovered that despite the elegant setting, inside the ballroom barracks, the life of enlisted men remained unchanged. Men lounged around in their skivvies, speculating about who was scared and who nearly wet their pants.
Sergeant Tomer, can I have a moment?
Tomer joined me. I led him to an empty corner of the ballroom.
How's Phillips?
He isn't talking. What happened out there?
His fire team ambushed an alien scouting party. It went bad.
He says he got White and Hewish killed. You were there. Did he do anything wrong?
It looked like a perfect op. Phillips slipped in behind them without being seen. He waited for the order, then he opened fire.
So what happened?
Those Speckers are damn near bulletproof. Their guns shot right through the ground. White was dead by the time the shooting stopped. Hewish... he hung on for a while.
Tomer nodded.
Keep an eye on Phillips. I don't want him doing anything stupid.
We're talking about Mark Phillips. When he gets like this, there's no stopping him.
Well, do what you can.
Tomer saluted, and I saluted, and I headed to base command.
Leave your helmet with my staff. We'll download whatever you've got and let the boys in the science lab have a look at it.
I handed my helmet to the major standing beside General Glade's desk. The man showed no pleasure in accepting it. He turned to salute the general, then left the office.
Makes a great secretary, doesn't he? He's a piss-poor excuse for a Marine, but he does okay as a secretary. I hate having assholes like him on my staff. There's something I want to show you. Let's go for a ride, Harris.
We went out and got into a fancy black limousine.
Head over to Vista. Vista's on the edge of town. You probably drove down it on your way in from the spaceport. Beyond that is Odin Street. But we don't want to drive on Odin right now. Odin is the kill zone. There are trackers, rocket launchers, and a hellhole of mines waiting for anyone who so much as taps a toe on Odin Street. The way things stand right now, Mo Newcastle's army boys are guarding Vista Street. Assuming those alien bastards come back, taking the battle to them's going to be our job.
Mo Newcastle was General Morris Newcastle, the highest-ranking officer on New Copenhagen. I had never met him before, but I knew the name. The closer we came to the city's edge, the more apparent it became that we had entered a military zone. Soldiers patrolled the sidewalks. Lines of trucks ferried weapons and supplies ahead. Troop carriers and armored vehicles choked the streets, and the traffic crawled.
Near as we can tell, they underestimated our numbers. The Mudders came in about 50,000 strong. We know that because we placed sensors outside the city.
The Mudders?
That seems to be the popular name for them around the ranks.
Is that mudder as in you mudder-specking son of...
The term is mud, as in the stuff you get when you mix water and dirt. Juvenile, I know, but what do you expect? The army came up with it. I think Newcastle likes it. Says giving the enemy demoralizing names is good for morale. The enemy does not appear to have tanks, jets, or vehicles of any sort. And they all carry the same weapon, some kind of light rifle. Frankly, I wish they had something else. Those rifles gave our troops a fit yesterday.
Maybe we can replicate their technology.
Did you get a close look at one? The damn things weigh a ton.
Yes, sir.
You didn't happen to fire one, did you?
No, sir. I couldn't find the trigger.
Yeah, we had the same problem. I'm sure the boys in the science lab will know what to do with it.
The traffic sped up as three trucks pulled onto the sidewalk and began offloading surface-to-surface rockets.
You've been firing STS rockets at them?
We used smaller ordnance last time, but we'll switch to STSs if the bastards come back. That was Colonel Moreland's idea. You remember General Tommy Moreland, the colonel's his son. His daddy died fighting in the Scutum Crux arm. He's got a score to settle with him. Says he wants to end this one quickly. Can't say that I blame him.
We arrived at the Vista Street Bunker, an enormous structure that stretched 20 miles along the western edge of the city. The car pulled to a stop, and we climbed out.
Wait here for us. We shouldn't be more than an hour.
The outer wall of the bunker was a 50-foot-tall structure made of 3-foot-thick steel alloy, protected by electrical shields.
How long did it take to build this?
About a month. The Army Corps of Engineers rigged a temporary broadcast station just for bringing materials in on special barges. It's amazing how the red tape gets cut when people are fighting for their lives.
The bunkers were the same lifeless gray color inside and out. The light from the ion curtain did not penetrate their gloomy depths. Bare bulbs hung from wires in the ceiling. As General Glade led me up some stairs, I saw a scattering of bright spots that looked like searchlights shining through the wall. It was not until we came closer that I realized the beams were coming from outside. They were holes through the yard-thick walls. The areas around the holes had the wilted flower look of molten metal. I knelt and looked inside one.
Pretty impressive, isn't it?
What happened?
The Mudder's rifles shoot right through our shields, Lieutenant. We were able to kill most of their troops in the forest, but a couple hundred of them got through.
And their guns did this?
And that.
Glade pointed to a matching hole in the opposite wall. The bolts had shot clean through both shielded walls. After that, the tenor of the tour became more somber. General Glade led me through the second-level corridor, an endless lane pinched between charcoal-colored walls, lit more by the beams of glare shining through the occasional hole than the lights hanging from the ceiling. We passed through a hatch and entered a metal catwalk that ran the length of the bunker. When I looked down from the catwalk, I saw barracks below us.
These are pretty shitty accommodations.
Frontline accommodations, Harris. Soldiers not posted on the front line are billeted in buildings downtown.
As we cut across the bunker, we passed technicians working on wall-mounted cannons. We passed a radar station. We passed gunnery stations. After confirming that the area was still clear, Glade led me onto the roof of the bunker. When I had flown into Valhalla, I saw an orderly city surrounded on two sides by pristine forests that were buried in snow. Everywhere I looked, I saw green and white under an ice-blue sky. The outskirts were virgin, and the city was clean. That was all gone now. There had once been a tidy suburb beyond the Vista Street bunker, an upper-class community with large homes and upscale shopping malls. I could tell that much by examining the smoldering battlefield that spread out before me. The enemy had been beaten back, but the battle had not been won as easily as I had been led to believe. The grounds below the Vista Street bunker were covered with the broken bodies of dead aliens. Now I understood why Lieutenant Moffat advised me not to waste my time bringing back alien parts. From where I stood, I could see the wreckage of a dozen gunships lying about like insects, both enormous and dead. The real carnage, however, lay about 1 mile out, where our intermediate defenses had battered the aliens. These aliens were killed by our heavy ordnance, rockets and laser cannons capable of destroying a building or sinking a ship. From the top of the bunker, I could see smoke rising from burned-over craters left by rockets and heaps of brick, steel, and dirt where buildings had once stood.
We lost 137 gunships. The army lost better than 20,000 troops. I'll say one thing for those bastards. They came right at us. I don't think a single one of them ever turned back. It didn't matter if we hit them with machine guns, grenades, or cannon fire. Those bastards marched right into it, Harris. They fought to the last. We got every last one of them. If they come back this week, the Marines take point. We have to beat them out there.
Glade pointed to the forest.
Stop them in the woods so the army can rebuild its perimeter.
3 days after their first attack, the Mudders returned. I leaped out of bed, pulled on my bodysuit, then clapped on my combat armor, the whole process taking less than a minute. I grabbed my M27 as a matter of course. As I headed out the door, though, I saw my particle beam pistol lying on the writing desk beside my bed. I grabbed the pistol, but still held onto my M27 for good measure. As I left my room, I joined a stream of men racing through the halls. We all knew the pecking order. Majors and up, heading to command shelters and wearing service uniforms instead of armor, went for the elevators. Mere lieutenants like me did not need to be told where we fitted into the hierarchy. I joined the mass of armor-wearing junior officers sprinting down the stairs to the lobby. We trampled down the stairs and out into the plush hotel lobby. Long lines of trucks formed in the parking lot. Officers in service uniforms segregated us into battalions as we ran, directing one battalion this way and another battalion that way. By the time we reached the trucks, they were breaking us down into companies. Our briefing, whatever briefing we would receive, would come as we drove to the front. As I headed for the trucks, I saw Ray Freeman running with a field bag dangling over one of his shoulders. Being a full foot taller than any of the clones around him, he stood out. We got into the back of the truck.
You have any idea what's going on?
Nobody's talking.
Across the bed of the truck sat Lieutenant Moffat, our intrepid company commander. As his executive officer, I took the seat across from him and waited for orders. Freeman sat beside me.
Harris, get me a head count.
They'd squeezed an entire platoon into the back of the truck, 45 men, including Moffitt, Freeman, and me.
Listen up! The Mudders are back! An army tracking station picked them up 7 miles west of town. They're headed northeast toward Valhalla. From what we can tell, the dumb bastards plan to hit the exact spot they attacked 3 days ago. We're gonna try to come in behind them. Command is sending 2 light infantry divisions to keep the Mudders pinned down while we flank them from the west. When we're in position, we will launch a counterattack, dividing their line in 2. Once we have broken their lines, our objective is to finish the bastards off before they can retreat. That is all.
I looked over at Freeman. He sat, his helmet on, leaning back against the wall of the truck, his huge body rolling along with the truck's bumps and jounces.
You think they're going to bring more men this time?
50,000.
50,000?
50,000, just like last time.
How do you know that?
I just heard from the science lab.
You're in touch with the science lab?
Freeman did not bother answering. We drove for less than an hour before the trucks pulled off to the side, and everybody got out and fell into ranks. I did not realize the sheer size of our convoy until I climbed out the back of the truck. A line of 200 trucks stretched out behind us, each carrying a platoon with 42 men. We formed into companies and headed away from the road. We marched into the trees, 10,000 men strong. My company belonged to the 2nd Expeditionary Marine Brigade. The 1st Brigade and several other units would pour into the forest from other directions. While the rest of us prepped our M27s, Freeman brought out his sniper rifle and loaded a magazine into it.
You're shooting bullets? I expected you to have something, I don't know, bigger. Maybe shoulder-fired nuclear-tipped rockets or something.
These will do.
Powerful?
Freeman pointed out a tree on a distant hill. Up on the hill, the upper half of a very large pine tree hopped in the air and fell like a bowling pin.
I'll meet you back in town.
Where are you going?
I want to get to their drop zone.
Why?
I have a package to deliver.
Something that makes a loud bang?
Something more scientific.
We marched 5 miles into the forest, moving east toward town. Our battalion would be the spearhead, the wedge that would snap the enemy column in 2. As we pushed through the forest, the echoing thunder of rockets became louder. Occasionally, we would pass some break in the trees and see tails of smoke rising in the distance. Then we crossed the invisible line bordering the battlefield, and the explosions became something we felt as well as heard. At one point, an ATV leaped over a ridge and exploded into a fireball. Through the flames and smoke and the glare of the ion curtain, I saw the bolt that speared the vehicle. I ducked behind a tree and prepared to fire. We had not run into the alien army itself, just a couple of scouts. The nearest platoon tried to pin the enemy with suppressing fire as a 2nd platoon flanked them and cut them down. But you cannot pin an enemy that has no fear of being shot. The 2 aliens marched forward and returned fire as an entire platoon shredded them with an endless stream of M27 fire. As if attracted to the gunfire, the next wave of aliens came pounding through the trees. An ATV streaked past, presenting a diversion. The Mudders did not take cover, but simply marched ahead, firing spears of light that bored through trees, rocks, and anything else they hit.
We got another large force heading in from the north. I want you and the closest 3 companies to form a skirmish line.
Spread out, spread out.
I moved up and down the line.
Tomer, take your platoon and cover that rise.
Moffitt moved among the men, doing the same. We only had a few moments before the aliens arrived. The 1st of them walked out from a stand of trees. More followed. Looking across our line, I saw Phillips out in the open, firing 3-shot bursts from his M27. White bolts struck the trees behind him and sailed through the air around him.
Phillips, fall back!
Tomer, always the guardian angel, climbed out from good cover so he could pull Phillips to safety.
Leave him! He'll get hit!
But Phillips had angels looking out for him. An alien light bolt drilled through the tree directly behind Phillips' head. The trunk caught on fire. Phillips seemed not to notice any of this. More bolts speared the ground near his feet and the bushes around him, but nothing hit him.
Harris, take your platoon and fall in around my beacon.
We can't hold that area. It's in their path, sir.
I gave you an order, Harris.
Following that beacon would expose our flank to the aliens. Moffitt had a point, though. If we could hold that area, we might turn the tide of the battle. I wanted to get to that knoll, but following a different path. I switched to a private frequency so I could speak with Tomer.
You got Moffitt's beacon?
Yeah! Is that for us?
No.
If I had told him the truth, his reaction would have been to follow orders.
Take the platoon in from behind the hill, and don't take any chances. Those bastards can shoot through rocks.
I watched Phillips, expecting him to ignore the order, but his programming won out. He stayed with Tomer and the rest of the platoon as they fell back, then moved up to take point as they circled the hill.
I told you to secure that hill!
We're on our way, sir.
Heads up!
Suddenly, hundreds of Mudders crested a distant ridge and opened fire. Grenadiers standing near the top of the hill fired rockets into the Mudders' ranks, then dropped back. ATVs poured in from every direction, firing rockets into the enemy line, then charging through it, weaving in and out around the trees as if they were running a slalom course. And still the Mudders did not drop behind cover or halt their disorganized march in our direction. Thousands of bolts of light rained down on the ATVs. But the ATVs were fast and low to the ground, difficult targets to hit. The rest of the regiment arrived en masse. Grenadiers launched rockets over the ATVs, and automatic riflemen fired an endless hail of M27 fire into the enemy line. I could feel it. I could taste it. The battle had swung in our direction, and in another moment, the Unified Authority Marines would begin another charge. By this time, I had lost track of which men belonged to which company. There comes a time when chaos takes over, and all strategy is lost on the field. We had reached that point. When I saw Mudders, I aimed and fired. I no longer entertained any objectives other than to kill. As I reached the top of the rise, I saw a Mudder no more than 50 feet away and fired over the helmets of several Marines. Hundreds of bullets bounced off the alien's hide. I did not see if it fell. The momentum of the regiment shoved me on, and I lost sight of it. A few feet ahead of me, a bolt seared through a Marine, and the Marine behind him, then a third Marine. The bolt pierced the first man in the head, the next through the chest, and barely grazed the final man in the arm, but all three would die. Whenever those bolts connected, it caused such trauma that a shot through the arm was every bit as lethal as a shot through the head. Switching from my N27 to a particle beam pistol, I continued to run in the stampede. The men to the right and left of me fell a few moments apart.
Move it, you spiking sons of bitches!
Once we reached the next ridge, the momentum slowed to a crawl. With every step, I pushed off the back or head of a fallen Marine. As I stumbled forward, I began to run into broken Mudders as well. 100 yards more, and the white of Marine combat armor gave way to charcoal as the battlefield became a junkyard of alien body parts. Our regiment slammed into the Mudders from the south and east. We continued to pour into them in a column, but they would not retreat. They tried to push back against us, but by that time, their attack had no teeth. We started out 10,000 troops strong, but had lost a lot of men. Our objective had been to cut the Mudders' line and stall their advance toward Valhalla. We succeeded at breaking their lines, but we did not stall their attack. Nothing could stall their attack. The aliens we did not kill continued on toward the city. To a man, these bastards knew nothing of retreat. Perhaps Glade had foreseen this. His 23rd Regiment came in from the north and east, creating an additional buffer across the city lines. They slashed into the enemy, creating a second front. Other regiments circled in behind the aliens, coming in from the south and west. Even then, the Mudders did not yield. They simply broke into groups and continued the fight until we struck down their last men. When we left the hotel for the battle that morning, we needed 250 trucks to transport the troops. We returned in 121, what was left of us at least. On balance, things seemed hopeful. I was given the order to report to General Glade's office.
Harris, glad they found you.
Congratulations, General.
Not much of a victory, Lieutenant. We lost a lot of men. I'm not so sure congratulations are in order. We can talk on the way, Harris. We have a briefing at the science lab, and they asked me to bring you along.
We went to the science lab auditorium as quickly as possible. There was a stage at the front of the auditorium, but the scientist running the show did not use it. He stood beside a table, the objects he placed on display along the table magnified on the screen above his head.
I understand we are all here now?
He was an odd-looking man, tall and skinny, built like the human version of a cotton-tipped swab, only bald. He had thick glasses, an unkempt ring of cotton fluff hair, and a lab coat draped over his skeletal body. The guy probably stood a good 6'4", but if he weighed more than 140 pounds, I did not see where he packed it.
We have made some significant discoveries over the last 24 hours. I'm not really sure where to begin. Under normal circumstances, I would publish my results and present them in a conference. Under these circumstances, I will present our findings directly to you. Over the last 3 days, we have explored the anatomy of the aliens you refer to as the Mudders. We have been unable to secure a complete cadaver for examination, so we've had to work on, the various parts that have been delivered. I have brought a head and some other samples of alien anatomy with me today.
The scientist pointed a trembling finger at the table.
When we received these parts 3 days ago, they were solid. We cataloged their weights at that time. Depending on the damage, heads generally weighed 98 pounds and 3.2 ounces. Arms weighed 133 pounds and 2.2 ounces. Legs weighed 268 pounds, 5.1 ounces. We received portions of torsos, though these were generally badly damaged. Upon examination, we found that the aliens had a precisely uniform body weight of 3 pounds, 6.3 ounces per cubic inch. The aliens do not have bones or muscles. They seem to be made out of a metal clay polymer that is foreign to our understanding. We've tried to analyze the material. I'm afraid we could not find an equivalent material on our own known periodic table of elements.
The scientist prattled on for another 5 minutes, comparing the polymer to various known elements and explaining how it differed. I heard whispered conversations starting around the room. No one listened until he said,
"The parts we have collected are rapidly degenerating. These alien sections were solid when we received them. They contained a solid mass of the new element that Dr. Sweetwater has labeled MBC, or more properly, Mudder Brown Carbon. When they first arrived, these alien sections were highly concentrated. We could only obtain samples for spectral and elemental analysis using a laser scalpel. Even so, we were able to determine that they were not composed of living tissue. Upon early examination, we found that there were no signs of entrails for analysis. We tried several experiments to see if we could break this material down to its most elemental form. We super-radiated samples with 300,000 grays. This material does not absorb radiation."
"Are you saying they can't be nuked?"
The speaker was an army general. I didn't recognize him.
No, sir. The trauma caused by the explosion might destroy the Avatar, but the radiation would not bother it."
Avatar? What the speck is an Avatar?
It's a representation.
A representation?
Like a computer game.
Computer game?
I understand you use computerized combat simulations to train your men.
Oh, battle simulations? What do the Mudders have to do with combat sims?
These are not living creatures. These are physical representations of creatures that are controlled by the creatures they represent. These samples we received contain no semblance of living tissue. As you can see, the material is uniform. There is no muscle or bone. It's almost as if this creature were a living statue."
"What about their guns? Those are real."
"Oh, the weapons. Now that was fascinating. The weapons degraded even faster than the aliens themselves."
"Degraded? You said that before. What do you mean by degraded?"
"Well, this creature and his weapon are made out of the exact same material. They are made out of the element we refer to as MBC. Also, the illumination shield that has enveloped New Copenhagen appears to be made out of that same element."
"Just to make sure I have got this straight, you claim that the Mudders and their guns are nothing more than computer characters made out of light? Is that what you're saying? Because if it is, we may need to find some better scientists. Those Mutter bastards were alive enough to kill 80,000 Marines today. Those were flesh and blood clones they killed out there. This was not some bullshit computer simulation.
No one is calling this a computer game.
Ray Freeman stepped in from the wings.
I see. I just wanted to clarify the point.
Thank you, Raymond.
Freeman walked to the edge of the stage and sat, watching over the scientist like a bodyguard.
When we received this limb, it weighed 133 pounds. This limb was too heavy for me to lift. Within an hour of our receiving it, we realized it had begun to degrade.
The scientist took hold of a forearm on the table with both his hands like a man breaking a stick. He snapped the forearm in two and held up the wrist and hand.
3 days ago, I could not lift this limb, let alone break it in two. Over the last 72 hours, the weight of this arm has dropped from 133 pounds to 27 pounds. The limb has become hollow and brittle. It is as if the MBC particles are evaporating. I cannot explain it at this juncture. Dr. Sweetwater has a hypothesis, but we need to put it to the test before we discuss it.
The scientist bent over and picked up a box that sat beside the table. He looked into the box, shaking his head as if trying to steel himself for a difficult task. Then he brought out something that looked like a 2-foot-long mud clod.
This is one of their guns.
That could not possibly have been one of the guns. It was the right basic shape, but it looked old and dirty, like something you might find rusting on the bottom of a lake. There was no hint of the nickel plating.
It is degrading to its tachyonic form.
The scientist turned the box over and poured out a small pile of dust.
This is all that we have left from a scientific instrument that was captured 3 days ago. As you can see, the instrument has nearly completed the entropic cycle. Everything the aliens create ultimately reverts back to tachyons and evaporates.
And what are tachyons?
Tachyons? Oh, why, tachyons are one of the great mysteries of science. They are a class of particle that is too small and fast for us to detect. We have no way of proving tachyons exist, but all of the data we've collected from the aliens are consistent with our understanding about the properties of tachyons.
Wait a moment, Doctor. So, you don't know if anything you have told us is accurate? It's all your opinion, is that right?
The data support our theory. Tachyons are particles that move at a speed greater than the speed of light. Theoretically, it takes a great deal of energy to bomb these particles in place. We've been able to measure enormous amounts of energy released by these body parts and this weapon as they degrade. I can try to explain the mechanics of this, but...
I'll take your word for it. It doesn't matter anyway. We defeated them, killed them, broke them. It really doesn't matter. My colleagues in the Marine Corps degraded a lot of tachyons this afternoon.
If our theory is correct, General, over the next 72 hours, the avatars will simply reassemble.
The picture on the screen was a familiar one. It showed three Mutters in their glowing form, the form that Morgan Atkins had labeled Space Angels, as they emerged from one of those light spheres in the forest. The picture might have been downloaded off of any of my men's visors, but I suspected it was taken from mine.
From what we can tell, the illuminated fields shown in this feed act as incubation chambers. We were initially stymied as to how the fields function, then Raymond provided the missing pieces for us to form a theory.
The picture of the Mutters vanished from the screen, replaced by a close-up view of the glass dish with the bullets on the table.
These bullets passed through the alien incubation field. The energy inside this field was so intense that it altered the composition of the bullets. Before entering the field, they were composed of a lead and steel alloy coated with Teflon. After passing through the field, the Teflon fused with the steel. When the spent bullets were first retrieved, they glowed almost exactly the way that the avatars glowed when they emerged from the field. Over the next few hours, the bullets attracted trillions of tachyon particles out of the atmosphere. By the time Raymond delivered the bullets to us, the tachyons had formed a cylindrical crust around them. Because the bullets passed through the field in a matter of milliseconds, they did not receive the prolonged charge necessary to form a lasting bond.
The scientist looked up at the screen again. He ran the video feed of the three glowing aliens a second time. As the last alien stepped out of the sphere, he froze the feed.
If our hypothesis is correct, the avatars leave the field as a mass of energy so powerful it is able to attract tachyon particles out of the atmosphere and bond them together.
So the particles, these tachyon things, are forming a skin around a creature made of energy? Is that your point?
No, not a creature. A signal. Remember, the beings you have encountered are only avatars, representations of creatures in another location.
Well, you said these same particles are what make their guns. That doesn't make sense to me. Their guns are too complex. How can they come together to make the working parts of a light rifle?
These creatures appear to have the ability to manipulate tachyon particles on a fundamental level. From what we've been able to determine, it appears the particulate matter that is attracted to the avatars remains constant, while the particles that arrange themselves into the weapon reform themselves into a wide array of materials.
Come again.
The tachyons arrange themselves into wires, prisms, or whatever materials are needed to create those guns.
So you know what's inside those rifles? Can we duplicate them?
Oh no, the rifles had degraded to mostly dust by the time we received them.
Just to be sure I understand this, you have no idea how they work?
No, sir.
The briefing lasted another 20 minutes. When it ended, the officers filed out of the room. We went back to Glade's limousine.
General, if the mutters truly are representations of creatures, what if the real aliens are so wrapped up in their avatars that they die when we kill the avatar off?
Glade, who had clearly lapsed into a foul mood, grimaced at the limo's driver.
What kind of a stupid idea is that?
I don't know. I'm just trying to expand the matrix, sir.
The mood around the hotel was somber when we returned. I was on my way back to my quarters when I ran into Moffat.
Where were you?
I attended a different briefing.
You had orders to attend the briefing with your company.
No, sir. You had orders to attend the briefing with the company. General Glade gave me different orders. Perhaps you should take it up with him.
General Glade? Why wasn't I invited?
I have a better question. Why was I invited? From what I could tell, the briefing was for generals and their staffs.
Care to share anything you learned?
I wish I could, sir.
You will tell me what you can when you can?
Yes.
I need you to rearrange the roster. Command wants volunteers to guard the henhouse. The paperwork is in the company office. They want our roster within the hour.
We traded salutes, and Moffat walked off. Still a prick, but a prick who knew when to back down. The next morning, I went to the ballroom that served as the barracks. The mood was somber.
It's not over yet, is it?
Sergeant Tomer came up to meet me when he saw me enter the barracks.
I don't see how this can end as long as they have that light field around the planet. We're still trapped. They're still out there.
Do you think they'll send a bigger army next time, sir?
Let's grab a cup of coffee.
Then, as we left the barracks, I told him the things I could not tell him in front of the other men.
As long as the Mutters have those light spheres, there's nothing stopping them from sending in more soldiers.
They let you in on more about this than the rest of us, didn't they?
Probably.
But you can't talk about it.
Probably not.
But it is bad.
I'm not going to talk about it. But it isn't good.
We entered the mess. The place was empty this late in the morning. We grabbed a coffee and sat at one of the tables.
One of the guys, Bull, maybe, thought the Mutters might take down the curtain if we hit them hard enough. You know, maybe drop the curtain so they can land more men. He figures the Navy has ships circling the planet and they'll drop off supplies and men once the curtain goes down. Does that sound possible?
The military can't afford to waste men or bullets. I wouldn't know anything about that, Sergeant. I hope you were right, though. I hope we can get more men and supplies. What about the rest of the men? How is your platoon holding up?
Most of them think we won.
We did.
Won the war.
Yeah, well, we certainly won the battle.
I don't get that feeling. You know something, and I know better than to ask what it might be.
I need you to keep your suspicions to yourself. Troop morale is strong right now. Let's keep it that way.
Some of the guys moved out this morning. I heard you signed them up for some kind of guard duty.
Battalion command wanted the detail to guard the hen house. I figured it might be a smart idea to send Phillips with him. Get him out of the line of fire until he gets his head straight.
The compound for officers' families? Are you shitting me? Please tell me that you're joking.
What's the problem?
A few years ago, Phillips nearly got himself court-martialed for screwing around with some officer's wife. Officers' wives are his favorite brand of scrub.